This is Sherry Yuen Hunter. Welcome to the Sandwich Parenting Podcast, where we speak with amazing people making the world a better place by helping others heal from intergenerational trauma. Sandwich parents are in between the way we got parented and the way we now want to parent our children. So we have here today with us mental health therapist turned coach, Angela Tam, who is known for their disruptive perspectives. After being in practice for 10 plus years in Washington State, working with adult children of Asian immigrants on racial trauma and healing from emotional neglect and healing from her own experience with racialized trauma, she started to coach others on how to do the same. So welcome, Angela.
Thank you so much, Sherry, for having me here and making space for me.
We're very happy that you've joined us. And one of the most important questions that I feel that I can ask my guests is, what is your origin story and how did you get here?
My story begins in Vietnam. My extended family were extracted during that time, during the 70s for the war. So they kind of came during that wave of folks, and they took 20 years to fully all arrive because of, you know, like all the factors that come with being refugees. And they came through different channels. So my mom came through working for the American government. And it was by a stroke of luck that she found someone at the airport in Saigon at that time, Ho Chi Minh City now, that let her and her mom through. And my dad came by like Southeast Asia through, like, he was a boat person. And they met here in New York City in the United States after being in a California encampment and being sponsored by the Catholic Church. And so for them, it was a reunion after being in Vietnam for so long, experiencing all this trauma with war, and then coming here. And then I imagine they were like trauma bonding like trying to like reconnect with the rest of their family, hustling for money, acclimating to a whole new world with really basically nothing and very little education. So my parents were not well-educated. My mom and my dad, I don't think, completed middle school or high school. My dad didn't do his high school studies. My mom only, I think, completed like her second year of high school. So I grew up in this brewing in the background. I like to talk about this because like so much of the gestational experience is like missed when we have our origin story. And it's like informing the like elixir of cocktails of like hormones that I'm like bathing in as like a little embryo. Yeah. And I know that's impacted my nervous system. I know that's impacted who I am today. So like growing up in utero in New York City, so my parents met in Vietnam as family friends, reunited in New York City.
What a miracle. I mean, that is like such a miracle.
I know. No cell phones back then. No emails, nothing, right? Like not even any pagers back then.
No.
So they were like through the grapevine.
How do you do that? No.
I don't know. They had no Apple AirTags back then either. So I'm like, who do you call? Like the local, like, is the question.
That's amazing.
They relocated to New York City, sponsored by a Catholic church, and they got married, I think, like late 70s, early 80s, and I was born in 83. So I was born during like a really tumultuous time in their life when they had very little resources, but they were kind of established. Like they had at that time maybe bought a house, which I'm not even sure how they did that, like great buy. And now I'm like, I got to fact check this because how did that happen? My aunt and uncle, my cousin lived downstairs, you know, like intergenerationally. My dad was a realtor. My mom, by luck, got a job at Chase Manhattan Bank, JP Morgan. This environment that I grew up in was just filled with stress, marital strife. I mean, there were kids raising kids, basically. They just did not have any foundation of conflict resolution or like emotional regulation. They were just like trying to get by, putting food on the table. And I was their only child. My mom was born in 1950. My dad was born in 1942. So they had me like at a really late age. They didn't really have a lot of like inner resources to like kind of deal with having a child. And I think they wanted a child because I think it was the right thing to do at that time culturally.
Interesting. So it wasn't so much, hey, you know, we really want to have a child and love this child and raise this child. It was more of a, it's kind of expected that we should have a kid. That's what you do.
I think so. Yeah. And I don't think they were prepared.
No. Well, okay. But is anyone? But yeah, so they were not prepared at all. Yeah.
No. And I don't even really think they were in touch with the parts of them that didn't want a kid.
That's interesting.
Or like wasn't prepared to have their expectations not met through a female identified child. Mm-hmm. You know, like my dad from birth did not accept me because I was a female. So he's very traditional. And he's basically
wanted a
like,
son.
Yeah, he wanted a son. And it was like I was dead to him from day one. So in my own therapy work, I've kind of gone back through this as an inner memory, but I just remembered, like, I remember not, and this is a felt sense memory, not like a real memory, but I just remember from a really young age, not feeling like I was loved or like had a sense of belonging. So it's like a very felt sense, like very real feeling. And so through this, you know, like a lot of my childhood did not make sense to me at that time, but it makes sense to me now that like my mom was a single solo parent, basically, even though they are still married today. Like her, the childcare responsibility rests on her for everything. Like the majority of like the childcare load and all the mental load associated with it, which is normal. But I think there was this added sense of like, not only is your dad like not wanting to participate in that because of like traditional male expectations, but like he didn't want you. Mm. And I think I, as a child, felt that. So I naturally sided with my mom when they had conflicts, naturally like glommed onto my mom as my protector or like my person. That from a really young age was like, so such a formative experience of like, oh, I, in order to belong, in order to be accepted, I need to do all these things. I need to like not have boundaries. I need to subject myself to be used as a punching bag or like a metaphorical punching bag or like a, like I need to be used as a means to an end for someone to accept me. And so like it was a recipe for like codependence and like people pleasing and, you know, like kids taking care of parents and being like their counselors and their best friends and their coaches. So I had like a PhD, Sherry. I had a PhD in this. I was like, you know how some people go into like master's in counseling programs in their master's degree program? I was like doing this from birth. So, and a lot of us therapists like end up being in these master's level therapy programs, licensed therapists, because we have leveraged our gifts while being in utero doing this, you know, like we were like a means to an end in utero.
Absolutely. Like all the, even like the pre-verbal types of things that, that are in your nervous system. And so for you, that's kind of what led you to, because you're constantly thinking about these things, because you're constantly living these things, it was a natural place to continue your studies. And that's how you became a therapist.
Yeah. Fast forwarding a little bit in my early 20s, during my college breaks, I would come back home and try to look for an Asian therapist or Asian American therapist, which at that time, because I'm 40 years old now, that time was about 20 years ago. There was not a lot, even in New York City, and we really, there weren't any directories back then with like Psychology Today. And
stuff. Right. So really yeah, quiet. That's huge now. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So in my early 20s, I just knew that there was like something off with my family.
And it was dysfunctional, you mean?
Yeah. To say the least. And then that's when I started my inner discovery journey of like, okay, let's pull back the curtains a little bit and let's try to see what's going on here so that we could make sense of everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then
relate to that deeply. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I share this in my Instagram posts, but in my early teens, my family was actually I grew up with a Buddhist faith in my family, and I converted to evangelical Christianity. And I don't talk a lot about this, but I really feel like that was a result of me being a lost child, looking for like some kind of secure relationship and spiritually bypassing in a lot of my pain. And at that time, it was a great survival strategy because it did get through my teens. And in my 20s, went overseas and became an overseas missionary in China. And when I was over there, I am no longer an evangelical Christian.
I'm no longer
consider myself. And that's like maybe a side conversation. And I'll just like briefly mention that, but it was American evangelical Christianity is too tied to American culture for me to like really parse out. And I know there's a lot of people who are decolonizing American evangelical Christianity. Mm-hmm. And I'm in touch with some of those groups and folks that are doing it. But still, for me, I'm not in a place where I'm like, right now, I don't think any labels on my faith would kind of describe where I'm at. Mm-hmm. Other than like in a ever growing decolonizing journey. And faith is wrapped up in that. So decolonizing my therapy work, decolonizing my faith work. So anyways, that's just aside. When I was in China as a missionary at that time, I experienced a molar pregnancy, and that resulted in a DNC. And so they told me, like, in order to prevent uterine cancer, you'd have to not be pregnant for 2 years. So you'd have to like not try. So that was what led me to be like, I'm going to get my priorities straight. I don't want to do this missionary thing forever. I'm going to pursue therapy. So that's a really long way of answering your question about like what circumstantially did spun me into therapy. It was my like family history of being a counselor to my mom, but also like the catalyst was my miscarriage.
This tells us how you got into therapy, but you've actually expanded how you do this work with your clients. You've gone from therapy to coaching. So I'm kind of curious about why you did that. And does this make a big difference for your clientele that you're a coach in addition to being a therapist?
So I had my first kid at age 30, and that was the same age that I started my private practice. It was like a year before that. So I was birthing like two babies, my small business, as well as my big business.
Oh my goodness.
Big business in the form of a baby.
It was like twins, twinsies.
It was something. It was, all right, Sherry, I don't know if this is smart, but all of my like dreamings happen when my kids are in utero.
Yeah.
Like
they're bringing you the dreams.
They're bringing me inspiration in utero. Either that or like my complex PTSD causes me to like get distracted, do all these like flighty things with my money and my time.
It's that impulsive.
I think from the
conflict trauma. I can raise my hand and say guilty. I relate to that. So far, I relate to quite a lot of this, except you have three kids. At the birth of your third child, you were like, wait a minute, I have a dream now. Like there's something that I want to do.
The dream. Okay. So the first baby, I birthed my mental health practice.
Yes.
My second baby, I started short-term rental properties. My third baby, I'm evolving into my coaching practice. And all three of them come from some kind of money wound or some kind of pain. I did my mental health practice during these past 10 years. We used it as a side hustle, not as the main hustle.
So
now that it was switched with my third baby coming, well, first of all, this third baby was a surprise baby. So that's a big like information piece that is important. She was the best surprise baby because it really allowed us to put all of our values in alignment into practice, like in alignment and in practice. With two kids, we could totally coast. Like we could do what we were doing and coast. But with three kids, we like really need to get serious about everything.
Planning.
And such little margins that we were like, oh my gosh, if we aren't intentional, we will literally get a divorce. We will literally lose our jobs. We will literally lose our mental health and wellness. And this is another side note. I discovered that I was queer just like recently. All these things are like complex PTSD stuff that I'm like, oh, I'm a late bloomer and discovering everything, like my hobbies, my values. And the part of me that is decolonizing really believes that mental health institutions and the medical industrial complex in the United States, and this is not the same in other countries I'm discovering, is that like we pathologize people for having understandable responses to systemic oppression and intergenerational trauma. So for me, I'm like, no thanks. If I want to be married to this institution, I need to like be real with the cost of like the toll that it will take on me to do this work. To pathologize folks. I know I'm not personally pathologizing folks, but like to be attached to an institution that doesn't align with my values.
You are being understanding of, you know what? It's not that there's something wrong with you. It's that you have been within these systems that don't work for you. And whether that is from an immigrant perspective, from a gender perspective, from a racial perspective, right? It's all understandable for you to physically and mentally have really bad reactions to being treated poorly. So it makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm like, how can I be a non-judgmental, unconditionally warm witness to your trauma if I am having to put a diagnosis for you?
Wow. Okay. So that's a big shift. Like that's a big shift because you've been trained to heal and to support people's journey through a healing process. It stems from a diagnosis and you're saying this is not aligned with how I see the world. And so you had to.
Yeah. Because the diagnosis manual that we use is racist and it's made from the perspective of like white dudes that thought that this is what the standard is. And everyone that deviates from white body standards is wrong. It's a deviant. Yes. And so I've never accepted insurance. And I only do cash pay as my mental health practice. It's still part of an institution that actually does harm for ultimately Black and Brown bodies. Yeah. That when they are quote unquote labeled as these diagnoses, they actually will be stuck in a system that will further dehumanize them. And no wonder a lot of people are like, F you, I don't trust you. I don't trust the system. The system has F me over. So I see like mental health institutions and mental health wellness industry as part of the extension of white body supremacy. And not only are they the abusers, but they're also the gatekeepers. So divesting from this for me is again like part of this like queering of my practice, but also helps me move into being held ultimately at the end of the day, Sherry, when I think of like what my legacy will be, how I want to tell my children about my decisions, I really want to live in living accountability with it. So like I'm like, I can't be saying one thing and being like, you know what, I just didn't want to follow through on that. At least I'm going in a direction where I'm like feeling better about it.
That's amazing. And so as part of your journey, you know, you've made this shift. And so the program that you're running, which I hope people will have a chance to see on your website, is called the Embodied Entrepreneur Program. And, you know, and you talked a little bit about your own journey. So it sounds to me like your target audience, you know, the group that you really want to support, would be Asian female raised, non-binary, trans entrepreneurs. So tell us a little bit more about this program and how you would actually help this audience as they're going through the challenges of being an entrepreneur.
Yeah, so I think the foundation of what I believe when I'm doing business coaching work is that the personal is the professional and professional is personal. So like your personal struggles, all that shit that happens behind closed doors, all those like conversations you have with yourself in the middle of the night or right before you go to bed, all those like closed doors conflicts with your partners or your kids, all of that is going to show up in our businesses in some way or another. It's kind of like any type of coaching, really. If you're in like parent coaching, if you're like whatever coaching you're doing, we cannot compartmentalize ourselves. So
very powerful, by the way, right? Because we've spent a lot of, you know, the past few decades talking about work-life balance, and it's just gotten worse and worse and worse, you know, with that people trying to have a balance. And really, especially now after the pandemic, personal and work, it's just so intertwined all day long. Like, how do you compartmentalize everything? So that's a really interesting, I've never actually heard somebody say personal is professional and professional is personal, but I really like it and I might borrow it because I really agree with you.
I didn't invent it, so I can't even take credit for it, but go wherever you want with it.
Yeah.
But I believe that another step of this healing journey for me as a baby therapist 10 years ago was that I explained I went into therapy, like being a therapist was a bonus, but me, it was part of a healing journey. And so I shared this today on my live stream, is I used to cry when like my clients would terminate with me, or I used to like be so torn up when they were like chronically late and I didn't know how to like set boundaries, and I didn't know how to like share about my fee increases. I didn't know how to like kind of share about late charges. I would get so torn up about that. And I was working out my attachment wounds and my like childhood wounds in my business. And so that's actually like a big part of my origin story as a mental health therapist, but also what the medicine of my coaching practice is. How do we, in our struggles with our clients, with our rate, our money wounds, our like boundary issues, our like being driven by guilt issues, our guilt wounds and abandonment wounds, how are they showing up in the minute-to-minute, day-to-day aspects of our entrepreneurial businesses? And, you know, as you know, like a rough childhood and like my complex PTSD is still here. And
I know.
Still like I part of me. And so how does it show up in our entrepreneurial pursuits is all these like little sneaky areas that end up eating away at our energy and 100%. A, get in the way of our clients' progress. B, get in the way from us earning revenue. C, disrupt our legacy journeys, our legacy that we want to impart in our professional businesses. Because we all want legacies, right? That we want to leave our culture, our society, our communities with. These like attachment woundings will disrupt them. And it will cause people to want to throw in the towel.
For sure. I think that what you're talking about, everyone can relate to, especially if they're struggling with their complex trauma. Because I used to think that you can fix the complex trauma naively. Like, I'm like, oh yeah, you know, we'll just get that fixed in a year, you know, and then everything will be fine. And now it's like, oh no, it's not about getting it fixed in a year.
Sherry, I hear you. I totally hear you on that. Like,
so after that layer, oh my gosh, look under the hood.
Gosh.
There's like so many more layers.
The onion is just like, you know, like Red Robin, or I forget like the store that has like the blooming onion.
Oh my God.
Deep fried blooming onion. Yes. It is like the infinite blooming onion.
No, it's infinite.
It like, does not stop giving.
No, no it does not stop. It doesn't stop giving. That's hilarious. The infinite onion. And so that kind of leads me to, you know, the other end of it, because you are a child of immigrants, you know, dealing with a great deal of intergenerational trauma, and you're now a parent, you know, to three children. And so what I'm curious about, and this is usually, you know, my last questions, because we are kind of getting close to the end here. But if you, so now you're a parent of three children, if you could give one piece of advice to parents as they're parenting, as they're struggling, as they're experiencing all of these things that we just talked about, not just in the context of their business, but also in the context of their children. And like you said, business, children, you know, they're all your babies. what is that one piece of advice that you would want to give people and that you would want to leave them with at the end of our conversation here?
So my one thing will be this. Generational wealth is not only about money and real estate and financial assets, but it's about inheriting a regulated nervous system, and giving that down to your children is when our kids talk about us, our grandkids, our great grandkids talk about us 3-4 generations later, they're not going to talk about the shit that we gave them materialistically. They're going to talk about our curiosity, our demeanor, our radical acceptance, our non-judgmentalness, our patience, our humanity, our rawness, like our ability to show up as real, authentic people with them who aren't afraid of leaving anything unsaid. That for me is generational wealth. It's internal resources I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's internal generational wealth.
100%. I love it.
A new status symbol, I think, will be emotional maturity and emotional regulation. That is,
it's rare.
It's going to be like more flashy and more bling than any Tesla mansion that I could give my kids. And I hope that that's going to be trendy. I hope that that's going to be, wow, you got that? You got that from your grandma?
Yeah.
Oh. That's so dope. I hope that there is a budget line for internal generational wealth building.
Love it. I love that. Thank you so much, Angela. I really enjoyed the conversation and I really loved all your insights.
Thanks for having me, Sherry.
Thanks for listening to the Sandwich Parenting Podcast. I hope that you learned something new that will help you along your journey. See you next time. This is Sherry Yuen Hunter signing off.